Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to Midpoint. My guest this week is a producer, writer and performer, a man who's turned his hand seemingly with ease from making top-class TV to appearing on it, and he's now got a chart-topping novel on his hands, with Hollywood knocking on his door. As we speak, he's a few months off 50. He's in the prime of his life, although he admits he may have got any midlife crises out the way early on. He's cultured and urbane, but loves his daytime TV. He went to Cambridge, but he's a man of the people. Heat magazine awarded him their Secret Crush Award. He might even be that nebulous thing, a national treasure. There's so much to talk to Richard Osman about, and none of it is pointless. Sorry. This episode is brought to you by Solgar, whose range of over 300 vitamins and minerals are carefully crafted to deliver optimum health when we need a little boost. Although they won't help my jokes. Right now, I'm loving their magnesium, which ensures a restful night's sleep in uncertain times. Oh, look, there's a train, which is maybe going to be a regular feature of this podcast, this particular episode. So, Richard Osman, it's so lovely for you to give your time up, especially at the moment, which, I mean, I can imagine your time at the moment has been taken up talking nonstop about your debut novel.
As we record, it's only been out 2 weeks, so it's been insane, which is great. And it's I'm absolutely thrilled. So yeah, you catch me in a particularly good mood. Whether 4 weeks ago about my midpoint, I'd have been like, oh, the thing is, Gabby. No, I'm like, oh my God, it's like the best thing ever.
Well, that's good because we can reflect on both. And actually, we'll get to the book in a moment, because the thing that I want to start off with is that if I'm to believe the kind of the dates and statistics and the numbers, you didn't appear on television properly as a kind of career move until you were about to turn 40 or around 40.
Exactly that, yeah. I think I was, late 39s, right. early 40.
I meet you today at late 49s as well,
right? That's pretty grim, isn't it?
So basically, you've been on telly for a decade.
Yes, I've accidentally been on telly for a decade, And because people often say to me, because as you know, I was behind the scenes for years and years and years on telly. I'm very happily behind the scenes and accidentally went on telly.
So tell us how the accident happened.
Well, that simply happened because, as you know, if ever you do a quiz show, you pitch it in the room. You actually play through the quiz.
Like in an office environment, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And we did that at the BBC for Pointless, down in the old TV centre. And I always make the producers play presenters. Always, because the producers know the show inside out. Mm-hmm. They know what can go wrong with it. They know which bits to kind of show up. So we did that. I played the role. The BBC liked the show. They said, we need someone like you to be you. And then they thought, well, you are a little bit like you, which I agree.
You might be the most like you that we can find.
Yeah, you're certainly the same height. They were very keen on that.
Did they like that? Was that a kind of feature almost that they liked the idea of you having this, not just a giant brain, but you were this big man?
I don't know. I think because it's people I'd worked with for years, because you work with the commissioners because you're selling shows, I think they thought, well, you're quite funny in meetings. So I wonder if you'd be funny on telly. So I said yes, because I thought you'll know as well as anyone. Most shows disappear, and I've had lots of shows disappear. So I thought, well, I'll do one series, something to tell the grandkids. And it's never stopped since, which is very, very peculiar. But I think the fact I was 39 made it rather useful for me to deal with suddenly being on TV.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you next, because you've had a life of anonymity, success, but anonymity.
Yeah.
I mean, relative anonymity. Obviously, within the industry, anybody who wanted a hit making would go to you, or they would,
Like anyone cares.
Like anybody within an industry that's good at what they do, but the public, you could happily walk down your local high street and nobody knew who you were. So then you go and this hit happens and you're in people's homes every single day. They feel like they now have you're with them. You're a piece, they're part of their furniture and their lives. So how did that
work? I think that for me it was fine because it happened quite late. I say late in life. Now 39 seems very, very young. But because I'd already had my career and I sort of felt quite formed, every single thing I've ever done on telly, I've been able to be myself. So I've never had to go, oh, right, yeah, I'll be what you want me to be. What, how do you want me to be? What do you want me to wear? What, you know, I was able to just go, look, I'll do it, but
this is who I
by
am.
The way, I'm just going to be me. And so I've never, in terms of when the public, when I talk to people in the street, they know their vision of me is pretty much me. Mm. And so I never have to pretend to be anyone or do anything. And so it's actually been rather nice. And where I live, where we're recording this, in fact, and you know this bit of West London traditionally been very TV and film and music. There's just lots of it, you know, centered around here. And so I'm like the 900th most famous person around here. And so like nobody cares when I walk down. I was at M&S the other day in the queue, and the guy at the front of the queue is lovely. He was saying, when are you back in studio? I said, oh, we're back, I think, on the 16th. He goes, oh, yeah, honestly, I'd said Stephen Mulhern in the queue yesterday. They're back on the 11th, but no audience. I was like, okay. That's the kind of neighbourhood this is.
The kind of grammar of the post office is all telly kind of talk, which is quite good. We moved out of West London to the Shires, and in my village, and literally on my road and kind of just around the corner, lived Mary Berry and Pauline Quirk. So
wow.
Yeah, so I had to kind of, I was not a novelty.
Yeah,
it wasn't
kind
of, you know. In fact, what the question people would say or ask me is, have you been to Mary's yet? You know, it's kind of, wow. So, yeah.
And have you been to Mary's?
Yeah, she cooked for us.
Get out of town, did she? How was it?
Amazing, as you'd expect.
Is it good? Yeah,
kitchen supper, darling. So in front of the Aga, she knocked up a kind of flan, an apple flan, a French thing, which I would probably take weeks to kind of have the guts to do. And she just did it that afternoon. And it was all very traditional.
And do you think she enjoys it? Because she must feel pressure, because she was always very, very renowned and then suddenly became super famous. And suddenly everyone who goes to their house, it must be like being Nigella or something. It must be hard to throw a dinner party.
She was totally unfazed about everything. You know, I love cooking, and I love cooking for a large group, but I get a bit flappy kind of, you know, when it's all happening. So then, of course, I had to invite her back.
Oh, I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
That's awful.
And that, I took the day off, literally. Yeah. I kind of said to my agent, block the day out. I'm making minestrone. And
wow. But did you make a pudding as well?
Well, I don't have a sweet tooth. I genuinely don't love dessert.
Okay.
Which has always been a fault of mine, because I've forgotten about it in the past, you know, and opened up a tin of pineapples and poured it on people's, you know.
Gabby, no.
I know. No. So I thought, I've got to do something. Yeah. So I did a slow cooked lamb, which took about 12 hours. Okay. I made my own mint sauce with, like, you know, a special.
Oh, she'll like that. Yeah.
Lots of, because her husband Paul's quite traditional. I thought, she doesn't want any of my newfangled modern, you know, Ottolenghi style cooking.
She doesn't want sushi.
She doesn't
It's Mary Berry, for God's sake.
A minestrone of a traditional recipe, you know. Yeah. So for pudding. Embarrassingly, I made a cheesecake.
Oh, did you?
Which is the world's easiest thing to make.
No, but, I mean, it has to be amazing then.
Well, she did say to my children that it was a very crispy bottom, because the kids weren't allowed to come, well, they weren't not allowed to come for supper, but they weren't involved in supper.
Yeah, I hear you.
But they came at the end in that Victorian style to kind of like chat to the hero, and because they loved her. And she said, your mummy's cheesecake has got a wonderfully crisp bottom.
Wow. And did you buy that was the truth? Or did you think that...
You're telling me now that she might have been lying.
But, you know, because she's nice enough on telly, I would imagine in real life, she's not going to say...
Do you know what?
Well, I've got to say, the lamb was very good. The mint sauce, a bit much for me.
She focused on the mint sauce. I'm not sure
she
loved the match. She kept focusing on that and saying this was something she wanted to make herself.
Really?
And, yeah.
Oh, that's the first appearance of a train.
Yes.
We're literally by
it's my tummy. I'll let you, the listener, decide.
Either we're hungry...
And we got sidetracked on Mary Berry, but just on that briefly, what made me laugh so much, she's so lovely and funny, and she was obsessed with my dressing room because she was about to build a new house. So sadly, she's left the village.
Oh, no.
And moved towards where her daughter lives. And she said, can I have a look at your dressing room? And she kept going up and taking a look at it with her husband.
Really?
I was like, yeah, sure.
That's quite cool.
Yeah.
She once came on Celebrity Pointless, and Xander to this day is just mortified, because occasionally on that show, when the audience come in, we swear because the audience really love it.
Yeah.
And Mary was on, and Xander, I can't even remember the context, but he didn't just drop the F-bomb, he dropped the MF-bomb.
No! Right, isn't that the top swear word on the BBC?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. He knew it wasn't going to make the edit, but it was, you know, it was for the room. But he said the second he said it, he just glanced over at Mary Berry, and he said she just looked crestfallen.
Yeah.
She didn't even look angry, she looked disappointed.
Yeah.
And he said, honestly, I couldn't concentrate the rest of the show because I knew that I'd upset Mary Berry.
It's so funny how some people have that ability to elicit those responses, isn't it?
Yeah. And this is a man who's met the Queen.
Yeah.
And he was like, Mary Berry was fine. Was,
he MF'd in front of the Queen for hours. Yeah. She was fine.
Yeah, she was. Well, she's used to Prince Philip, isn't she?
Mary's almost more regal.
Although I think so, in a way, Prince Philip,
who is currently alive at time of recording this podcast.
Exactly. That's after how many times have we had
99?
To... I've spent like the last 15 years making topical television shows. And every time you're like, oh, just be careful with this Prince Philip bit. And he's just, you know, he keeps going.
Everyone else you've talked about had to re-edit, yeah, but he's still there.
Yeah.
For all kinds of other reasons. Right. So here you are, suddenly, not suddenly famous, but suddenly recognised and known and having notoriety. And was it everything you thought it would be? Because you must have seen loads of people become famous on shows that you've been involved with.
Well, that's exactly it. And I mean, you know, making shows over the years, lots of comedy shows and things, certainly loads of comedians I've seen before, you know, before they were ever on telly, you know, Catherine Ryan, Alan Carr, Frankie Boyle, Jimmy Carr, all of the, you know, that
I
whole...
I knew them all when they weren't famous.
But I did, you know, I did because purely because I'm old. Right, purely because I've been around for a really long time. So pretty much anyone who's famous who's younger than me, I knew before they were famous because it's... And some people it really suits becoming famous, and some people it really doesn't suit. Some people it really chills them out. And, you know, you feel like they've earned something and they work hard and what have you. And some people it really sends off the rails because they... And usually the people who got a bit luckier to get famous because they have to, in their head, justify why they're famous. And so they have to go, oh, no, there's something great in me. That's why I did it. But it's because of something in me. And that, I think, sets them off the rails. Whereas lots of stand-up comedians usually take it quite well because most of them have, like, worked their guts out to get there because they've toured up. And that, exactly. And they can kind of work out why they're famous because, you know, they know the thing they did.
I think that's like anything in life, isn't it? I mean, the biggest kind of analogy, I suppose you could say, is like a big lottery win, which sends a lot of people off the rails.
Because
it sounds great to win £100 million, but actually,
it does.
Bloody great.
It really does. Wait a minute, where's this sentence going?
But you can see how, actually, if you've been somebody who all your life has had a strong work ethic, suddenly you kind of go, oh, I'm not quite sure how I got here, and I haven't. There's been no incremental steps to get there.
Yeah.
You know, I've gone from my very modest, tiny little house to a mansion and people wanting stuff, and that's a bit like that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's right.
About.
And you know, In money terms, you know, your life is spent knowing what your priorities are, which is keeping your family safe, making sure you can pay the mortgage next month, making sure you can pay the rent, and suddenly that disappears. And for famous people, it's been, there's that sort of rocket fuel of, I want to make it. It's really, I've got to make it. I have to be there. There's competition with other people. Mm. And suddenly you make it and you see them kind of go, oh, sorry, what do I do now? What's my rocket fuel now? Mm. Now that I'm selling out arenas, what is it that's supposed to motivate me? Because I know it motivated me before, which was, wouldn't it be great if? Mm. And then it's, well, it is. But that's the thing with success is, and the thing that messes some people up about it, is that thing of they have to have more of it. You know, the second you're selling out an arena, and then suddenly Peter Kay is selling out that arena for 3 nights, you're like, oh, I'm an idiot. I can't believe I only sold this arena at one night. I need to talk to my agent. Why do people hate me? You know, and that's you see it with people when they come into money as well. You know, and they'll buy like a really expensive house, and then they'll see there's a house in the street next to them that's even more expensive, and they're like, ah. Oh. And you think, oh my God, what a waste! You spent all that time making all that money buying this beautiful house, and you're still as unhappy as you were before you got that one because you want the next one. So the real secret, isn't it, is to kind of go in, oh, I'm really comfortable with where I've got and what I have.
I'm happy.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's the way to deal
so
with.
So by the time
fame,
you and Xander appeared on Portlist, do you think you'd reach some level of happiness then?
I think that I'd got to the end of one career. I think I'd done probably everything I was going to do in TV production. I would have carried on forever because
I was going to say, if it hadn't, Pointless hadn't happened, you'd still be doing it though.
I probably would have gone straight into writing, I suspect, because that's where I started as a writer. I definitely thought, you know, I built a big company up with a group of other people and had been successful.
This is the other thing, you were financially successful.
So
telly
was,
wasn't your route to riches. You'd already had financial success.
Yeah, presenting wasn't my route to riches for sure. I was, yeah, so and that's BBC. The other nice thing is I've never ever needed to be on TV to
you haven't
work.
Chased.
Yeah, I can sit back and sit in my house and write or come up with shows. So yeah, so I'd done that and I'd had that career. And so, yeah, you have to look for a new challenge every sort of 10 years or something, even if it's a hobby, you've got to take up something. And yeah, so I took up being a quiz show host as my new hobby
as
for
your
10
mid-life.
Years.
And the other thing as well is you'd already separated from your longer term partner and got, so that stuff in a way is also important, isn't it? Because if, if you start something new and then all that stuff happens, from the outside people think, this is, it's gone to his head. He's like, you know. But so you were in a stable situation at that point in terms of you had your routine sort of.
I mean, listen, I'm more stable now than I was then, but who isn't? You know, you should be spending your 40s getting more stable, I think. But yeah, I think that I didn't have, I think, you know, if there's such a thing as a midlife crisis, I went through it 10 years earlier than people are supposed to, which is quite good. You get out of the way. I had dinner with a friend of mine recently who's a very senior judge, which is hilarious. If I've known her since she was 18, and you would not have put money on that. Northern Irish girl, who's great.
Just go and checking all the senior judges in the country and work out who's from Bangor.
And she, you know, we both said, because we, you know, I think we both had sort of minor crises in our mid-30s. And here we are both kind of 50 odd. And we're both just saying, I mean, we both seem like really happy and sorted. And around us, there's all sorts of people who are having their crises now and who are losing their minds. And we're sort of saying, maybe it was a good thing we got our crises out of the way quite early, because we seem to have a good long run of happiness, you know, up to this age, which is quite nice.
And then, so you've now, you've alluded to it, you've obviously written a book which is not just successful, it's kind of, you know, blowing others out the charts in terms of its statistics and its numbers and its critical acclaim as well,
which is lovely,
which is more than lovely. I mean, it must be so satisfying.
Yeah, I'm beyond thrilled. It's like a culmination of something. It's you know, I always wanted to do it because I've always been a writer. And I wrote the book that I wanted to write, and I'm really proud of it. And my thing has always been in telly and in everything. If you're proud of something, it's easy to sell it. And I love the selling. I love, love, love getting as many people to watch something as possible. Like, you know, that's what it's to me. That's creative as well. But only
that's
if
really interesting, because it's I quite enjoy that process as well. Yeah. But you've got to be confident as well, haven't you, that what you're selling is...
Well, that's literally the only thing, and that's with anyone who's in sales, and great salespeople usually are selling something that they believe in, you know, because, I will go on any telly show or talk to anyone if I've got something that I love. If I've got a show that I love, I'll go in and pitch my heart out because I know it's great. If I've got something I think, oh, this is a bit of a catch-in, this is a bit cynical, I will go and sell, but you're a bit kind of, hmm, and then when you sell it, you're like, oh, God, we've got to make that now. And so it's lovely with, you know, House of Games, which I do now, and with the book, that I can go and talk to anybody about it. And just, I love that thing of getting people to buy something because that I know they'll enjoy.
And they are buying it. And not only are they buying it, but Steven Spielberg bought it to turn into a movie.
Yes. Yes, I know.
Honestly, Richard, you're 49, you're 50 later this year. Can you imagine, though, your 30-year-old self having Steven Spielberg kind of come along, and the man who created E.T. wants your book?
I know, right? It's listen, I don't know what to think about it, other than I literally got an email from my agent this morning saying, oh, Steven Spielberg's literally just emailed to say he wants 10 more copies of it to give to people. You think, okay.
Oh, no, he's got to buy them.
Yeah, exactly. It's fascinating that, and I'm able, I think, to divorce that from my ego, which is one of the most important things about being at a midpoint, because of the business side of it, and because of my business brain can kind of go, well, that, you know, so me as a human being, I'm incredibly proud and excited. So that's lovely. And I'm really chuffed that he likes it, because obviously he doesn't know me from telly. But then the other side of my brain can take over as well, which is thinking, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what will happen with it. How can we deal with it? How can we make that as big as possible? Mm-hmm. And so I'm able to enjoy it, but then focus the kind of energy that gives you, and it gives you a lot of energy, into something positive, I hope.
Oh, well, I'm sure. Now, you just mentioned a friend of yours who's a senior judge, and was she a university friend?
Yeah.
So you went to Cambridge.
Yes.
And I imagine lots of your peers have gone on to do quite amazing things.
You would think so, but not really.
Oh, really?
I think because I tended to mix with all the state school kids at Cambridge, and we all kind of, it turns out that the Cambridge is much less important than the school you went to beforehand. So, is the lesson
so
I've
the
learned.
So the networks that they all jumped back into after they came through is interesting.
Yeah. Or they knew how to accelerate
progress.
They knew
how to do it,
You know, and me and my friends didn't.
I don't think Cambridge will be looking back and thinking, oh, poor Richard.
I can't complain myself, but yeah.
But you to get into any of the top class universities, you've got to have some kind of intellect and some kind of, you know, thirst for knowledge and everything that goes with it. So when you're obviously a very urbane, very clever man, and I love the fact you defend telly a lot, you know, you love popular culture and modern television and kind of programmes and how important they are to society. Do you ever have a moment where you think, oh, if I'd done, I should do something that's, you know, a bit more kind of world changing. And could I have done something with my intellect that kind of would have solved the crises, various crises on the planet right now?
Well, listen.
Or are you able to just go, no, I like telly?
But here's the truth. And it's a truth that, that other people might want to ponder on sometimes, is I'm not that clever. But I'm not. You know, I'm just not. I know the limit of my intelligence. I know when I bump my head against the glass ceiling of my intelligence, right? I'm clever enough to do the job that I do and to do it well. And so I'm clever enough to do something where I think I make people's lives a bit better just in terms of making telly or writing books, and I'm good at it. I know clever people, and they're cleverer than me. You know, I know various people who are professors at various places, and I talk to them. I think you understand the world far better than I understand the world. I get a vibe about the world, about what's popular, how to sell things. Mm. So I can do that sort of thing. But in terms of policy and in terms of the earnestness needed, I'm not clever enough. Mm. You know, I'm a very different sensibility, but I'm Boris Johnson. Which is, listen, I can stand up and sell you something and be charming and all that kind of stuff, but you give me something difficult, I can't really do it.
Do you think he's clever enough to be our Prime Minister?
Well, I mean, of course not. You know, but he should be an advisor. You know, he's a sales guy, and that's absolutely fine. I don't mind that. Other than if you have the ego that then says, "Oh no, I reckon that actually I could solve all the problems of the world," and you know he can't. He's too lazy.
Is he?
He doesn't have attention to detail, and that's the same as me. I don't mind that.
Is he? Do you think? And this is a thesis maybe for another day. But is he not the product almost of modern television in the sense of kind of, you know, if you look at something like a Big Brother or any of those kind of talent shows which are Pop Idol or X Factor, where you thrust somebody forwards very quickly and it's the populist vote. That's kind of where it all came from.
You know
from.
What? It's not, I mean, but that's entertainment, and entertainment's always been that, and entertainment's always made immediate stars. You know, it used to be, you know, comics, and then it's, you know, real people. It's the product of 24-hour news.
Mm.
It's the product of this absolute insatiable growth of news having to move at speed, and social media and having to have a reaction, because that is an easy place for a showman, you know, or a showwoman. That's the easiest place to be, because you've always got something to react to, and you can make a mistake and move on immediately. It's like stand-up doing a set. You know, suddenly you're getting feedback. You know, so it's the way we do current affairs and news in this country that's led to that. And that, by the way, has had an inevitability. It's not some evil hench person sitting there and creating it. But yeah, it's you know, we live in a witocracy, really, which is, if you can be entertaining, you know, you can do whatever job you want.
I know you just said that you're not qualified to do lots of other things, but actually all the things you've just described sum up a lot of your, you know, kind of persona in terms of your public persona and things that you are able to do. I was doing a kind of little bit of research for today. I thought, you know, because you think you know somebody, but let's just see if there's anything else. And one of the things that I'd forgotten is that you were, what was the secret, Heat Magazine's top secret crush? Was
that? Yeah.
Which we don't need to go into. But the other thing was, I can't remember which popular website, it might have been Buzz or something, had your top 25 tweets. And I was laughing out loud. I was in my office, and my husband was around the other side going, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "Just some of Richard's tweets," which I'd probably seen the first time, but collated. That ability to kind of like to distill something is what modern politics seems to make a success of people.
But you know, genuinely, and I do think there's a million things I can't do, but that is something I'm quite good at. That's the skill that I have got, so that's what I use. But being able to do that makes me look at today's politics and just going, we've got the wrong people in charge.
Mm.
You know, we need the thinkers in charge. We need the doers in charge. We need the earnest people in charge. Boring though they are, you know, that's who you need.
But it's very hard. Who look like they might spend an hour at least thinking about a problem, you know, and actually having the time to think about a problem and not just knee-jerking everything, which seems to be how our whole...
And I've spent a bit of time with a few people in politics recently because I'm fascinated by it. And I always ask, look, who cares?
Mm.
And they'll go through the same people's names that always mentioned. Some are Tory, some are Labour. But they say, no, those people really care. You might disagree with them, but they care. But I don't think Boris would be one of those particularly. That's absolutely, you know, it's okay. You can have whatever career you want. I'm not judging. As I say, I'd be very similar if I was in charge. You know, I think there are very few people on the front line of modern politics who would be in that group of people. But there's so many people, so many... On point that, you know, we snuck off MPs all the time and this, that, the other. Then on pointless, you ask the names of people, of MPs, and no one knows any of them. So we seem to think we can take an opinion on this group of 650 people without knowing who any of them are. And actually, the second you drill down into it, there's an awful lot of hugely intelligent, hugely hardworking people. Mm. But their voices have been lost because of the speed of our culture. And again, I'm not bright enough to know how to turn that round. The only thing I'm bright enough to do is to try and promote the things that I believe in, which is warmth and kindness and trying to find compromise with people that you might disagree with. But I don't have any clever solution. Some people I know do have those clever solutions, but they're not going to be heard.
And the only reason I ask that question is not to kind of like, you know, make out that your career is successful as it is, you know, you could have changed the world. Just that I think that's kind of a midlife theme in a way. And, you know, I know that it's what I question myself about most, you know, kind of like, oh, maybe after your law degree, you should have become a barrister, a human rights barrister, which was the area of law I really wanted to work in if I was going to do it. And instead you're reading football schools out, you know. And
so, someone's going to do it, though.
So that is the thing that I think creeps up the most in terms of any anxieties.
Yeah. I think it's exactly right. I think at this age, certainly one thing you're thinking is, how can I do good?
In terms of, I mentioned that you separated from the mother of your children in your late 30s, and then you have this new career in your 40s, and we're going to have a relationship expert today.
Yeah. Oh, I could use that.
Well, I don't know. Can you use that? How has it been for you being single in your 40s?
I mean, it's really great, I would say. Which I know is not one of the things said. I've had a couple of relationships which have been longest term and which have split up, which I have regrets about in different ways, but these things absolutely happen. From my perspective, it's wonderful. I mean, it's, you know, it's I think it's probably easier being a single man in your 40s than a single woman, because women, by and large, are much better to date than men. And when I talk to my female friends about their dates, it's like, you think, that is unbelievable. What, he really? And she goes, yeah, but I suppose, but he's got a job.
He owns some socks.
He was wearing a different shirt on the second date, the first, so that's something. Whereas, you know, if you're a man, you can date kind of astronauts who, you know, sort of have set out stand-up tours. And it's kind of great, and I think also I try to age appropriate date, and so you are also dating people who know what's going on as well, and you know their own minds and are decent human beings, and so it's sort of easy to start dating. It's easy to stop dating. It's
want to have a kind of somebody that is the person you grow up with.
Yeah, I think is so. That important? I definitely always really wanted. I'm much better in a team. I'm much better as a sidekick. I love it. You know, I'm a second in command, really. It's what I like. So I want to be with someone who I can kind of elevate. So I love that. But, you know, the older I get, the more I sort of think, well, but also it's okay not to, because I'm surrounded by lots of really great friends.
What was your parents' situation?
They divorced when I was very young. Of course. I mean, duh. A cliche, I am. I don't have an experience of a couple growing staying together and growing old together.
I think you're the first single person I've spoken
to on this podcast. Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, which is interesting.
It's interesting. Were they single when they started? And then by the end, they were, after the podcast went out, they went, hold on.
By the end of the podcast, I had them all fixed up with people. Yeah. But no, it only occurred to me kind of yesterday. I was thinking, oh, that's interesting that everybody's kind of in, you know, living with their, I mean, God, they might all be massively unhappy.
You know, exactly. And also, give it 5 years, Gabby.
Yeah, some of them were a bit younger.
Some of them were,
actually, John Bishop, who was the first person I spoke to, did separate from his wife and got back together with her.
Oh,
which is and very similar to you in as much as until he was 40, hadn't earned a penny from doing stand-up. So had that kind of moment at 40, which that was one of the reasons I wanted to start this anyway, was that people listening feel like, actually, do you know what, I can do that thing. And as he said, it's not gonna always be doing stand-up, it just might be something completely different in their career.
I think you know, there's a lie we're sold, which is life is a continuum, and you sort of climb whatever ladder it is, and you sort of don't. It's kind of a step ladder. At one point you do get to the top, and then you can sort of wander down the other side and back up, and you know, there's no and when you get to that, sometimes I think people, you can feel it's your fault. You think, oh, I sort of run out of enthusiasm, and what's wrong with me? And, you know, everyone else has got this life, and I'm feeling like, there's something short. You think, no, I think you just get to it. It's like a car. You know, after 10 years, you know, probably the engine is gone, and, you know, you just need to replace the
carburetor. Kickstart and do something a little
bit. Yeah, and I think that's very, in the in my book, everyone is in their 70s, and they're sort of solving murders. But one of the beautiful things about it is they're living in a community full of other people in their 70s, and they're forming friendships, and they're forming new friendships in their 70s. And you know, and my
and getting new hobbies.
And, exactly, you know. And that would be my view. I think we have to keep refreshing, and you know, it can be something as simple as changing around the living room furniture. We all know genuinely. That can give you 6 months, right? Just going, oh my God, every time you walk in the living room, you think, this is, oh, I've made a good decision here. And, you know, or yeah, it can be a hobby, it can be changing a job, it can be going and doing volunteering, charity work. There's so many things to do. But if you are feeling there's something lacking, then that thing is not lacking in you. It's something that's lacking in life.
And it doesn't have to be changing your partner, but this seems an appropriate time to bring Annabelle Knight in, who might give you advice if you did want to change your partner. Or if you are thinking, do you know what, actually, I want to give this a go and try and see if I can. Because that's also a thing, isn't it? You don't necessarily have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Could be just that you need to address why it is that this person that you were madly in love with not so long ago is suddenly really annoying you.
Genuinely, it might be you change the living room furniture and suddenly you fall back in love with your husband.
Annabelle, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have been on all kinds of TV shows over the years, from Big Brother to Loose Women to Breakfast Television, sharing your wisdom on relationships. So we're particularly focusing on the middle of life and the kind of late 40s, 40s, 50s kind of area. And I was interested to read recently that there are more divorces happening in that period now than there were before. They used to be the 30s. The early 30s seemed to be the kind of peak for divorces. But it would seem people are kind of either they're sticking in a little bit longer or they're getting married later. What's your theory on that?
I think that maybe a little from column A and a little from column B. We are tending to do things later in life. In general, now people kind of move in together later, they have children later, careers develop over a longer period of time and they become more of a focal point. So there's all these distractions which may mean that your love life gets put on the back burner, so to speak, for a little while. So a lot of people in their 30s are not even married, let alone looking for a divorce.
That's why they're not divorcing.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, things are happening a little bit later in everyone's lives nowadays. People aren't so much in the mad rush to settle down. I don't hear that phrase bandied about anymore. It's kind of grandparents and my parents' generation that would want to settle down, so to speak.
So in a way, Annabelle, it's quite sad, isn't it, that if you're waiting longer to settle down or you're waiting longer to find your life partner, that you're still not actually, you know, making it work. You think in a way, you can understand somebody getting married at 22 and then they get to 42 and they go, oh, I'm not going to spend the next 40 years with you, so I'm going to call it a day, you know. But if you're not getting married till your late 30s and then it's still kind of, you know, crumbling away in your mid-40s, I don't know, is there any hope for any longevity?
There definitely is hope. I think with couples and with relationships, being able to talk to your partner, and I talk about communication until I'm blue in the face, and I often am met with eye rolls because every single couple I meet think, well, of course we communicate, we talk every single day. But real communication involves active listening, honesty, and openness. And without those three pillars, you're just talking hot air. So with communication, it is about raising those issues as and when they arrive so they don't fester, so they don't become something more than what you can handle as a couple. It's really important after communication to just be completely honest with your partner in all aspects of your relationship. And that is everything from your financials and the day-to-day running of your shared lives to things in the bedroom and things out of the bedroom as well. You know, your friends, your family, absolutely every element needs to be met with complete transparency so that you have a really good chance of making that relationship work in the long term.
Totally brilliant advice. And three, I like honesty, openness.
Transparency, honesty and openness.
Which are all brilliant and make perfect sense. And it's interesting what you said there about on all aspects, because I imagine if you've been married to somebody for 25 years, if you suddenly decided you wanted to change something in the bedroom, you know, alarm bells would ring from the other partner, wouldn't they? Suddenly you started being honest about sex. Like, why didn't you mention this 10 years ago? You know, that's quite a difficult... It's easier to talk about money, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is quite a difficult subject for a lot of people to tackle. But sex is something that, you know, we all do. We all have with our partners, unless you are in a sexless relationship. But for the most part, the majority of people enjoy being intimate with their partners. But the majority of people don't know how to express their needs, wants and desires with their partners because, you know, we're very stiff upper lip. We put up and shut up. We lie back and think of England. All those kind of things that you are met with kind of across the board societally. But that is changing. People are getting more confident in the bedroom. I love the rise of like body positive influencers and sex positive influencers because their message, while... you know, a few years ago, it may have been met with rolled eyes, is now being absorbed by the masses. So we see a lot of people, you know, deciding, actually, my sex life isn't quite what I want it to be. It's not terrible, but it's not amazing. And it can be amazing, and you should want amazing, and you should strive for amazing. So a lot of people are now becoming more confident. And even if they're not quite at the point where they feel they can speak to their partner, they're at a point with themselves where they know that they want to be able to speak to their partner.
Okay, so they take the, you know, the bull by the horns, sounds like the wrong metaphor for this occasion, and they have that conversation and they're open and they're honest and they're transparent, and still it's just not salvageable, okay? And sadly, they decide they're going to part company, they're going to move on, which is always traumatic, whether you've got kids or not, if you've been together for a long time. Then they're back out there in the wilderness again. And for a lot of people in their kind of late 40s, mid 40s, they haven't dated anybody else apart from their long-term partner for 20 odd years. So, you know, getting out there into that landscape, which has changed so much since, you know, their first time they were dating, is quite daunting, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And what a lot of people don't do is give themselves enough credit for what they have just been through. A relationship breakdown is a trauma, and it needs to be kind of dealt with in such a way that you are ready to go into the dating world afterwards. Because if you jump in too soon, you end up seeking out relationships, whether you mean to or not. But subliminally, you seek out relationships that are going to fail because you're not actually in the right headspace to have a successful relationship. So giving yourself that grieving time, and that time to, you know, reconnect with yourself, reconnect with what life means to be single, all of those things are really important before someone jumps back into the dating world.
Does that include just having a casual bit of sex with somebody? I mean, would you say like try and be celibate, try and really and just enjoy your own company?
Well, no, I wouldn't necessarily say try and be celibate, but I would say if you're seeking something
more meaningful
and more long-term than just, you know, a little bit of fun, then definitely give yourself the time. But of course, you know, a one-night stand or a fling can be one of those building blocks to building that bridge to your new life. So it really depends on the individual and the person. But definitely take your time. And think about what it is that you need for yourself in order to move on.
Just finally then, how are people in the midlife meeting other people? Are they using dating apps? Are they actually having face-to-face kind of meetups? How does it work?
Dating apps with kind of people in their 40s and 50s are becoming increasingly popular. We can see data that shows us that, you know, for the 40 plus age group is one of the most burgeoning age groups for using online dating. With the apps, I think a lot of people are trying them, but they prefer dating websites where you get to put a little bit more information in, and it's not quite as instant because that instantness is a little off-putting for people.
You've got to be quite confident, haven't you, to do that?
Yeah, exactly. And if you are used to meeting people in a more organic setting and letting relationships grow, whether that's your, you know, a lot of people meet their partners at work or in a, like an external environment or through friends. It's very, very in your face. It is. I am single. I am looking for someone. Please approach me. And you get, it's called micro rejection with dating apps. So every time you match with someone that doesn't match with you, you get a little sad feeling. But every time you match with someone that does match with you, you get a little hit of dopamine. So it's a little chemical rush either way with the dating apps. I think if you're not used to that kind of fast-paced and instantaneous dating lifestyle, it might be a little bit of a shock for you. my advice for anyone looking for online dating is to have a look online at the different types of ways you can date online and pick the one that kind of fits in with you the best.
Annabelle, thank you so much. I think I'm happily married at the moment. Obviously, I hope I don't need any of your advice. But if I was listening to that and I was at the end of a relationship or I was heading out into that dating wilderness, I think I would feel very assured and reassured. So thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So you're not too bothered about kind of going forwards, whether or not you meet somebody. It's not, you know, being married isn't a particularly kind of priority for you.
My overriding the way I try now to live is, so like with this, the book coming out, and it's been really an extraordinary 2 weeks in terms of sales and reaction, and all that's lovely, but I'm really, really aware that in your life you only get three or four times where that happens, where suddenly every bit of news is good news, where it's just lovely the whole time. And I'm really trying to, because I also know that that will then dip and, you know, then it will start selling less and this, that, or the other. So I'm really trying to remember every single bit of it and enjoy every single bit of it. And, you know, that's the, you know, people bang on for years and years, but you've got to try and be present. You've got to try and be present in the day and appreciate what you have. And it's an almost impossible thing to force yourself to do. But I think over the years, it's come much more naturally. So at the moment, I'm trying to think, look, who knows what's going to happen in the future with anything, with work, with relationships. But every single day you have where you're happy. In the book, Joyce, who's the narrator, she says, look, if you have a good day, just put it in your pocket and keep it with you. Because, you know, they can't take it away
from
you.
Joyce is the kind of wisdom, isn't she?
She sort of is. She's sort of slightly homespun wisdom, which is great. But, you know, that's the thing. I always say to friends, I say to my kids, if you've had a good day, if you've had a, you know, what, don't sort of think, oh yeah, but now it's gone. Yeah. You literally just think they cannot take it from you. And you'll be 17, you'll still look back and just think, ah, that was nice. And I say, you know, when you're younger, you dream forwards, right? Which is, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And as you get older, you start dreaming backwards, which was, ah, remember that? Wasn't that lovely? And it's, you know, so you've got to pack your pockets full of those dreams, I think.
So you're in the moment, and because of all the things you've been through in your career, that's a good place to be right now, to be in the moment. You know, you're not worrying about what's coming down.
Well, because, you know, genuinely, the one thing life teaches you, you just never know. And you spend a lot of time, maybe in your 30s, maybe in your 40s, trying to get some control over what's going to happen next and trying to think, oh, no, but if I do this, then this will happen. If I do this, and oh, my God, but what if that happens? And actually, after a while, you have to think, hold on, that just doesn't work. It literally never works. All it means is I'm quite anxious a lot of the time. And it never means that the stuff comes true. You know, the stuff presenting point this, right? Some stuff just comes out of a clear blue sky at you, good stuff and bad stuff that you have no way of knowing. So it's, I think it's better, anytime you have a bad day, remember, listen, there's tomorrow. And every time you have a good day, you think, great, I'll tuck that away.
What about health, though? Because that is something that we can plan a bit
for.
And that's been a theme, I think, from kind of various experts that have been on this podcast, that actually your kind of insurance policy for your health has to start before you have a major catastrophe, you know. Men are kind of more prone to that, waiting for something bad to happen.
All right, Gabby.
Well, women, actually, it was interesting what Ian Marwell, the nutritionist, said. He said women have had diets rammed down their throats since they were kids, whereas men have not. Sorry, that's my stomach's really
adding to another train.
And it had some kombucha, which I shared with you before, didn't I?
Yeah, and it hasn't had that effect on you. Had the impact.
And that's a train,
that
not
is
the kombucha. And so women, because of that, are probably more aware when new things, health messages come along, whereas men tend to kind of put things off, wait for something to happen, and then go, oh, I better do that now. So are you quite good at like having health like checks, whether it's kind of just something mentally that you do, or
I thought you were going to say you're good at avoiding the doctors. I was about to say yes, Gabby, yes I am. And again, also women, there are a number of things where they have to go to the doctor, so they're used to going, and men just are not used to going. You know, there are not kind of, you know, mandatory prostate checks don't start perhaps when they might do. So no, I never go to the doctor. I never get ill. I get skeletally because I'm 6'7". My joints are all shot to pieces. I need my knee replaced and all that kind of stuff.
Physio and things.
Not really.
No.
You know. So yeah, I don't really take care of it. I would say I know I have to, and I think you know, you want to be as fit at 60 as you are at 50. I think is the
so
big
plan.
So what
are you going to do about it then?
Just exercise, you know. That's all you can do. I mean, food is food. And listen, I was a child of the 70s. I'm never going to get on board with, you know, 10 a day and all this kind of stuff. It's just, I'm aware it's not going to happen. So
how would you rate your diet on a scale of 1 to 10?
And 10 being 10 bad.
10 being very healthy. 10 being like, you know, kind of vegan, never touch processed meat. I'm completely healthy.
3, I would say.
There's work to be done.
It really depends on how healthy you think Watsits are, I would say. I never really go to the doctor and I absolutely know I should. I don't get ill, but, you know, most people don't get ill is the truth. But yeah, but I can see now I'm going to doctors more often because I had back issues about 5 years ago, which seemed to have sorted themselves out. I've got knee issues now, and that's going to keep going and going. But I think just exercise and eat less. And that's, you know, there's...
Just eat more of the good stuff, maybe.
Yeah.
No, maybe. Do you just hate it?
I've never... It's always been a blind spot of mine. So I do try.
Because you didn't have to worry about it because you were kind of needed a lot of food.
It's never been a thing for me. But yeah, I'm aware I do have to. But the truth is, the more you take care of yourself, the more you take care of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, if you do start, you know, like I haven't exercised through lockdown because I need to have had this knee fixed before lockdown and I didn't get it fixed. And
shame you didn't get it done just before. Wouldn't it have been perfect?
Oh, would have been literally perfect.
I had a few
friends
who just had surgery on things and amazing time. Like, even people that had babies just before. I spoke to Owen Morgan, the England cricket captain.
Yeah.
He had a baby 4 weeks before. For a cricketer to be able to spend time at home.
Yeah. Poor guy.
He loved it. He was like...
he pretended to love it. He was like...
Do you think he was lying? He wasn't on this podcast, obviously, because he's very young. I'm clearly not going to be able to persuade you to kind of go and, you know, change your diet, do lots of healthy things.
Things I can do. I love it when I'm on an exercise kick.
Right, so you do.
I love that because I get a proper thrill and kick from that. And being in shape is.
But
brilliant.
You're right about the health checks. Well, hopefully you'll never have so much success that you just stop working completely and just sit around having long lunches all day.
But I love to work though.
But I was going to say, that'd be a waste. You want to work. You want to keep going.
Funnetize, don't monetize. That's what I say. And, you know, my thing is always, writing the book, I want it to be successful because if it is, then I can write another one because I really enjoyed it. And if I do House of Games, I want the series to rate really well because then we do another series because I know I enjoy it.
It's always disappointing in telly when you've done like a couple of series or something and you've really loved it and the third one doesn't come along because
worst, right?
Yeah, I was like...
You love the team.
Yeah, a show I did, a Saturday entertainment show where the Thursday was always the writing day and we'd have our kind of big meetings together. Mm. We'd get in some Leon and we'd sit around and I love the Thursdays. Mm. Fridays was a rehearsal day, Saturday was show day, and I just liked that process. I loved, and when it didn't happen, I was I missed the Thursdays. I missed the whole kind of routine of
it's
it.
It's exactly it is you
it
know
was Splash.
People say great show. Nothing wrong with Splash. But you know, people say TV must be glamorous and exciting. And you kind of go, no, not really. And then you think, hold on, it sort of actually is. Anyone who works with a team who they love is working in an exciting, glamorous job. Right? You just have a laugh with people. And over the years, you work with the same people, and people you trust and people you've worked with before. And then you bring on younger people. And telly is full of people who started as runners and are now like commissioning editors at channels. And it's just lovely. It's such a lovely ecosystem. Success means that you can do it again. And that's the main thing.
And you have achieved lots and lots of that, and I'm sure there's loads more to come. I think the way I'd like to leave this podcast now, the end of this podcast, is I don't give you a present or anything, by the way, a medal or anything.
You know that if this is going to be meaningful, the train's going to go past right in the middle of it.
No, I'm slowing that sentence down, hoping. No, is that actually I should have finished when you said something about 10 minutes ago, which was about living in the moment, because I think that's probably the best position to be in midlife, isn't it? If you can get to that point where you just start to appreciate every day. So
you don't want to go too far in the future because you know what's going to happen.
Good luck with everything, and great to see you, and I knew you'd have lots of lovely little kind of nuggets of wisdom for us. So
it's been great fun, thank you. And no train during that lovely ending piece,
which means it was really important. The universe
the train they stopped the trains. I think Gabby's summing up.
Some controller further down the line said this time. Have a great day.
Thank you.
I always love spending time with Richard because he's got this incredibly well-rounded approach to life. He's a super high achiever, obviously, and that could be intimidating, but he's very approachable and so interested in what's happening around him. He's got this thirst for new ideas and people. I think that probably is what keeps him quite young. And I also like his honesty about his reluctance to adopt a healthy eating lifestyle.
which could mean that he might benefit with a couple of Solgar Omniums every day. Thank you so much to Solgar, to Richard, to Annabelle for her relationship advice, to producer Emma Corsham at Rethink Audio, and finally to you for listening. I'll be back next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.